I'm going to become the kind of person where being alive is worth it. Like, that's what I said about myself in that car, in that moment, that experience in Colorado. I said, I'm going to try to become the kind of person where being alive is worth it. And I don't really know how to do that, you know? Like, I don't know. What that looks like for me, I have to find that out. That requires risk-taking. But I want to become the kind of person where being alive is worth it. Hey everybody, it's Leviathan. I want to talk about integrating my shadow for a little bit. This episode is going to be very, very special to me because the topics and things I'm going to discuss this episode are my whole life in the making, as in this isn't stuff that I could ever have done without very, very extreme environmental pressures on me. They say people only change if they want to change, and I think that's 150% true. At the same time, sometimes people only change if they fundamentally have to survive, if that makes sense, or if their environment calls that out of them. Like, they're in the crucible, and they have to change to survive. They cannot stay the same person they are and expect to survive much longer, or at the very minimum, thrive, right? I'm under the impression many people know what I'm talking about when I describe the shadow, but I'm just going to do a really fast overview in case you're not familiar with what the shadow is. This episode is essentially just going to be me describing my shadow, just outright saying it. So the shadow, as described by Carl Jung, the inventor of the shadow and of modern analytical psychology, the shadow is all of the things that we reject or deny from our persona when we are learning social skills. So when we are young and we're trying to figure out how to socialize with people, we are trying to discover what works and what doesn't. And the only, when you're like, let's say anywhere from the ages of like 3 to 7 years old, or I mean your whole life really, but 3 to 7 years old, really, when you're young, you're trying to socialize and you're trying to figure out how to fit into social groups. And while this is going on, you're trying to kind of figure out what works and what doesn't. And what works, what seems to work, you'll go, oh, okay, I'm going to do more of this. And if something doesn't seem to work, then you'll kind of throw it to the wayside and you'll forget about it and not integrate it into your social persona. And over time, the effects of these things, we start to take all of those things from our persona and they start to blend in with our personality and we start to become, in a lot of ways, the person that we portray ourselves to be to other people. A really good example would be if you were in, you know, second or first grade and you decided socially that you thought it would be really funny to run around to all the kids and start calling them names and bullying them just because you thought it was funny. And what you started to notice is that nobody likes when you do that and you're just being a jerk and no one wants to be friends with you. Well, over time, you will take that as part of your social persona and go, hey, maybe I shouldn't do this. And you sort of cast it to the wayside, right? And over time, there's this filtering that sort of happens, and we sort of build the social persona that we're able to show other people. And the parts of that social persona that we use the most, we tend to identify with, but there's lots of parts of our social persona that we throw completely to the wayside that we just don't use and don't integrate into our personality. And then those elements are just not a part of our character. And in order to have a well-rounded character, we have to be able to look at the other side. It's like the yin and the yang of the personality. Like, you may be extremely in touch with the yin, but if you haven't integrated or even analyzed the yang, then you're only 50% person. You just don't have the rest of your personality analyzed and integrated, at least in a way that's considered healthy. Now, before I tell you what my shadow is and elaborate on that, I want to tell you who I was before I integrated my shadow. And put it simply, I was a rug. And I'll say how I found out about this. When I was very young, let's say fourth grade, fifth grade, not even, like probably younger than that, I wanted to fit in like every other kid. And I was able to make friends, you know, like I could make a one-on-one relationship really easily. What's funny is that I could never seem to fit into friend groups. Every time I fit into a friend group, I noticed that I struggled really hard to fit in. And we're talking groups of 3 to 5 or more kids. I just didn't really know where my place was, and I couldn't really figure that out as like a kid. And often I noticed that other kids would sort of try to compete to be the, I don't want to say leader of the friend group, but I think a lot of people know what I mean when I say like leader of the friend group. And I learned from a young age, it would be easier if I were to just let people make fun of me than try to fight to be the leader. Because if I let people make fun of me, then they'll actually integrate me into their social circle. So through means of self-deprecation and almost self-bullying, if that makes sense, I kind of learned, hey, if I do this, people will keep me around. And it's way less work than having to actually fight to be the leader, if that makes sense. Because I think there's sort of like a, at least with the social circles I've had, there's sort of a having to prove yourself to the social circle. And I just never felt like it was worth the effort or the work or something. I can't really describe it much more than that. But like I said, the end result of my childhood social environments and social circles and socialization was I just decided it would be better to be the butt of the joke, you know, to be the class clown that gets laughed at, because then I don't really have to do anything and everybody likes me and integrates me, but they like and integrate me because I let them make fun of me. And this creates a social persona, right? And the problem with that social persona is that I then start to take all of those values in, and I start to believe these things about myself that people are saying, or the things worse yet that I'm saying about myself that make other people like me. And what stinks about that is that in the real world, people don't like people that just constantly complain about themselves or talk down on themselves. And I had to learn the hard way that being a rug, you know, being the kind of person where everybody walks on me in order to be able to socially fit in and be able to be socially accepted, I realized that that just really wasn't going to be a good long-term strategy for me going forward, because it worked sort of before. But as of now, it's just not really the move. Almost every social environment I go in and I basically over-dedicate and over-commit and say, hey, yeah, I can do absolutely anything. And I just am a rug. I just walk into a room and just lay on the floor and say, step on me. This is who I used to be. And people, as you can imagine, took advantage of that. And they said, oh, wow, perfect. And they would just exploit me. And then a precedent would get set that said, hey, we're just going to step on you, you know. And once the precedent gets set that they can just kind of use me like that, I get stuck, because then there's really no way to fight once the precedent's been set, especially once lots of time has gone on. A lot of people, I'm sure, are probably going to relate to a lot of the stuff I've been saying here. So if we take this idea of me being a rug in my life, and we were to try to flip it 180 degrees, and we were to say, what is the exact opposite of a person that I just described? What is the exact opposite of somebody that just gets walked on top of? And I spent a lot of time writing this stuff out and thinking about it. These aren't the only bullet points, but I have a couple bullet points that I want to read outright because I think that they're well articulated and I can elaborate briefly on all of them. But I think when I read these, most people are going to go, wow, like, yeah, I wish I had those too. And so I'm going to go through all these bullet points where I describe my shadow, and I'm going to articulate how I figured these things out about myself, as well as who I was before I integrated some of these things. The first one is I am a respected leader, which is kind of funny because you might think that seems like a pretty straightforward thing, but you have to remember I chose to take the pursuit of becoming a respected leader and just threw it away because, like I said, it seemed easier, almost in a lazy sense, to just be the one that everyone made fun of. You have to sometimes fight, often fight, in order to have respect, because you have to prove that respect to other people. And it just wasn't something where I felt like it was worth fighting for. And in my current day-to-day life, now I need that quality. I need, especially in business, I need to have respect given to me. And I'm not talking about anything extreme. I'm just talking about not being manipulated, not walking into a room and saying, hi, I'd like to do this job or something like that, having people lie to me. Or thankfully, I'm in a very loving relationship with my wife, but obviously I've dated girls that are very manipulative, and I don't want to be a pushover. I want to be somebody that people can look at and respect and say, this person, not so much I'm on ice with this person, but I want people to look at me and be like, no, like this person has earned my respect based on their qualities and merits and vice versa. And like I said, it's the antithesis to me not respecting myself, me just degrading myself, me being very self-deprecating and self-bullying so that I would be able to fit into a social group. It's essentially the opposite of this. This is number two. I don't need to know the future because my competency and character demonstrate that I can figure it out as I go. One of my biggest insecurities in the whole world is the future. Was the future. This one's gone. I mean completely gone. When I get to the end of all these, I'll explain what happened that caused me to just straight up obliterate my old self. But I don't really worry about the future anymore. I used to be really insecure about the future because I had this need to feel smart, like I could figure it out, like I could know what was going to happen. It was like knowing what was going to happen before it would happen made me feel smart. But also, it wasn't actually possible because you can't know the future. The need for me to know the future was based on a lack of the ability to believe that I could handle an uncertain future, if that makes sense. Because before, I felt like I couldn't handle the future if I just suddenly lost my job or something happened, like obviously COVID and stuff. If something scary happened where the future was in question, I didn't believe that I had whatever it took within me to handle that I would make some earth-shattering, painful decision that would ruin my life and the lives around me, or that I would drop the ball when it mattered the most, or I would let the people down around me. And I realized that that entire strategy of trying to predict the future to prevent being incompetent, it's a completely different framework, and it's a framework I don't agree with anymore. Instead, now I believe that I can't actually know the future. And once I've accepted that I can't know the future, that's okay. That requires, that demands competency from me to be able to handle it. And so I've essentially flipped my framework inside out. And now I don't believe that I know what's going to happen tomorrow, but I believe I can handle it. Number three is I am capable, competent, and confident. People don't argue with me because they know they can't push me around, and I'm too valuable being in their corner for them to risk losing me. This one's particular, and these are where they start to get kind of Machiavellian, and I don't, like I said, they're extremes. When I worked in the real estate industry in Michigan, in the Metro Detroit region, we had clients that would roll us over. They would say, hey, the house isn't ready for pictures, or, you know, could you make a bed? You know, just, we had clients that were valuable enough to us that we couldn't afford to lose them. And I watched that and I saw what that looked like. And obviously, fortunately, a good portion of those clients never took advantage of that position of what I would consider to be power over the company that I work for. Some of them certainly did. Some of them just pushed us around and said, you know, if you didn't have us, you'd be screwed. You know, I think that that's a very, very disappointing thing to do, where you just take your value to somebody else and exploit it. I think that that's a really Machiavellian thing to do, and I don't want to do that. But at the same time, there's something to be said internally and externally about being so valuable that other people, it's not so much that they sort of need you, but people rely on you, and that's a fulfilling thing. It's a lot of work, and there's a lot of responsibility, and you owe it to the people that rely on you and count on you to be there for them, right? I have had lots of realtors push me around. They pushed me around because I wasn't specifically because they were valuable to me and I wasn't valuable to them. And there's this demand I have now internally to flip the script and to say, no, instead, I'm going to be the one that becomes the valuable one. I want to be the one that provides you value that you can't be without, the way that you provided me value that I couldn't be without, but in a way where it's not Machiavellian and it's not a power dynamic. It's just straight up It would be fulfilling to me. It would be a nice thing to have, a simple, almost like an Alan Watts sense. Just, it would be a nice thing to have. It doesn't need to be any more than that. Number four is I am able to meet the needs of myself and those I care about on a moment's notice. The last couple of years, I have been struggling to meet my needs, but part of the reason was because I didn't believe I could. Because I think everybody in life has these callings that are like quiet callings for what they are supposed to do. I have always had this calling on me as someone that does digital media to just straight up ask people at certain businesses that I'm either in or that I'm passing, hey, would you guys like video? And that always scared the crap out of me because I was so scared of no. I was so scared of what if they don't want me? I'm so scared of them rejecting me. All these things that I also was scared of when I was in fourth grade socially, and I was rejected the same way. It kind of comes full circle, right? So meeting my needs was one of those things where I kept like feeling like I was like constantly struggling for air because the perspective that I was working with was that I wasn't actually capable of meeting them. And I'm fundamentally reworking my belief about my ability to meet my own needs and saying, no, actually, I can meet my own needs. If I need a job that pays me well, I can apply to hundreds of places. And it's really annoying and frustrating to do 25 interviews. And it's really frustrating and annoying to have to deal with all of the crap that goes into that, but I can actually handle that. I can do it, right? Number five is I am extremely dependable and reliable. I can figure out absolutely anything in my field and can make promises on skills I don't have because I know that I can learn them and people know this about me. People will ask me to do something we both know I don't know how to do and I can figure it out and deliver without question or issue. And this doesn't make me a slave, it makes me competent. This is a very specific one because I had an interaction a couple months ago where someone just came up to me. I'm not going to get into details, but they said, could you run Google Ads for me? That just out of nowhere. I mean, and it was like not in an appropriate setting. And I was like, I don't know. And I wanted to be honest. So I said, I don't know if I can, as opposed to just being like, yeah, I can absolutely do that. Right. I didn't fundamentally believe that I would be able to figure it out. Right. And I've lost opportunities because I wasn't able to just say, oh, absolutely. Yes, I can stick to my guns. It's not lying to be able to say that I can do something that I can't do in that moment. It's lying to say that when you know you can't figure it out, and or to say you can do it like you've done it before, but you actually haven't. That's lying. I think being upfront and saying, I'm pretty sure I can figure this out for you. Yes, I think that's a very honest thing to say. And I hadn't up to this point believed in myself that I could do that, but now I do. Now I actually do believe that I can. I'm moving a little bit faster through these. Number six, I'm not fazed by mistakes. I learn from them. Holy crap. There's a story that has been in my mind for a long time. When I was two, when my mom would throw me like a little beach ball and I dropped it, I'd bawl and sob and lose my mind because I could not handle failure. And I think that's interesting. I still don't know exactly where that comes from. Can you fail so hard that you can never recover? I think the answer is absolutely yes. But it's a gray area, right? And it's not obvious where the line is with it. So for me, I just go, well, I'm just never going to fail. And I have this, there's this thing in psychology, and I'm completely out of line talking about this without the research. I don't know where, but black and white thinking tends to be a defense mechanism. If you're being chased by a cheetah, you're either alive or dead, right? And so black and white thinking is usually a defense mechanism to like keep us alive. And the amygdala is really good at screaming at us, hey, you're supposed to be alive, right? So when I was very young, I internalized this idea of black and white thinking when it came to mistakes. And I said, I either make mistakes or I don't. I very much struggled when I would invest myself fully into something and it would fail. It was like the biggest heartbreak. It would let me down so bad that I would like never want to do anything again. And I can't really say why. Like I said, it's just kind of part of my, at least it was part of my personality where I would try something and it would fail. And I would be like, oh, that's the end of the world. You know, you're never going to accomplish anything. You're never going to amount to anything. Like that was what I would tell myself. And I just don't want to live that way anymore. I want to be able to boldly make a mistake. You know, a simple example is like if you're in the gym, many people may relate to this. You're in the gym and you're like scared to do a lift because you don't know if you're going to do the form right. And you're like, is somebody going to be watching me while I'm doing this form? And you're lifting and you're insecure because you're like, what if while I'm lifting, I do the form wrong and I break, you know, throw out my arm or something, or I blow my rotator cuff or my Achilles. And then everybody's like pointing and laughing, saying, hey, buddy, you did that wrong. You're going to hurt yourself. You know, like this snowballing thought of how badly you can fail and how badly things can get. I think things don't get that bad that fast, really. They really don't. They can, but it's extremely rare. And there's usually like glaring red flags in those cases. The final point, number 7, is I am unafraid to speak my mind, even if it is Machiavellian and inconsiderate. This is because I believe I know what's best for people I love or care about, or myself, even when they wouldn't understand or believe me. I tell them anyway, because I don't remotely struggle rebounding if the interaction goes poorly. So I'm going to describe this now. So I have a lot of people in my life where I have listened to how much their situation sucks. And they go, man, I don't know what to do. And I'm scared to suggest something to them. And I'm scared to stand up for myself. Standing up for myself is kind of just a universal thing. But I have a lot of people, like I said, where I care deeply about them and I believe that they need to know something. And what I have to say may actually be of value to them. And I can't know until I say it, but I believe, you know, I want to say something. I want to stand up for myself, or I want to tell them something that I think they really need to hear. And I'm just scared to say it. I'm just scared to get it out and say, hey, I think you really need to know this. I think you need to know this about me, and I need to stand up for myself. Having had spent a quarter century not standing up for myself and not speaking my mind, I no longer worry about the repercussions for standing up for myself, because I have to learn how to stand up for myself in order to stand up for myself. I have a lot of situations in my life where I don't know if I'm speaking out of turn standing up for myself, but I try anyway. I try to stand up for myself, and I don't mean it in an extreme way. I'm not violent. I don't yell or anything like that, but I don't just sit around and go, oh, well, yeah, there's nothing I can do. I don't do that anymore because it didn't get me anywhere. And I've been tired of it not getting me anywhere. And so I've now decided that instead I'm going to say what I believe I need to say about something. And I back it up with some evidence or empirical data or something. Another reason why I struggled with standing up for myself was this belief that if I did, I would lose people, right? Because if I stand up for myself and somebody doesn't like that, then they're going to leave. They're going to be like, well, I can't manipulate this person anymore. I'm gone. And so I've now focused my efforts on doing the internal work to be able to tolerate if standing up for myself loses me someone. Does that make sense? Because if I have a relationship with somebody, it could be business, could be anything, for me, predominantly business, and I stand up for myself because the client's being unreasonable or the employer is being unreasonable, that's a big one, and I stand up for myself and they don't like that, yeah, that might risk an explosion. But it wasn't worth me, because I just did this, it wasn't worth me being a rug my whole life. I would have rather tried standing up for myself, because I will never regret the lessons I learned from standing up for myself. And that's exactly what happened to me. That is exactly what happened to me. And going forward, I have to stand up for myself. I'm going to do it until I can gauge where the line is on how best to do that. When do I like not scream, and when do I scream? Like, when do I say, hey, no, this is not okay? And when have I pushed it too far? And I would much rather grow claws than just be harmless, because that's not going to net me anything in the long term, being harmless. I don't believe it will. Certainly not in today's world. Now, all of these traits that I've described with my shadow, I'm going to tell you how I integrated them. It was very violent, as in it was very extreme. It was a very big step in my life. It was a very emotional moment, and I'm never going to forget it for the rest of my life. And I'm going to tell you guys exactly what happened. And it's a very emotional story. As I said, I had the opportunity to go to Colorado for basically $200. And I took it. And it cost me my job because I didn't have enough time to be able to do the to do this trip, and I needed to do this trip in order to regain my sense of identity and humanity that had been stripped away from me, that I let get taken away from me. And as I said, I stayed with my buddy. He lives west of Denver out in the mountains, and I got to Colorado around 4 p.m. on Tuesday. We had chicken and rice and then went to sleep. And then Wednesday and Thursday were probably the most intense days of my entire life. Long story short, my friend would not let me sit still. This dude would not trust me or let me stop and just enjoy the time out there. We went and did stuff. We went out and shot. I shot a handgun for the first time, which is pretty sweet. And we did a bunch of other fun stuff. But we were just constantly moving, constantly getting stuff done, doing stuff out of the house. And my buddies were taking me to the gym and they were having me max. These guys were giving me weights I couldn't handle. They were putting me through the ringer. It all came to a head on Thursday when my buddy, who had taken the week off of work, decided he was going to go into work. And he said, "I don't trust you in the house by yourself because I think you're going to play video games all day. I want you out of the house." And like I said, this dude was just being really strange. He was my friend was just being really like rude and stuff. It wasn't based on any clear reason. And I was really confused what was going on because he wouldn't listen to me. He wouldn't like there was a lot of stuff I wanted to do. I want to go climb mountains. Like there was stuff I wanted to do out there and he just wouldn't listen. He just kept saying, "This is what we're doing." He was just barking orders at me. And I just and I was a rug up to that point. And so I just kind of kept listening and listening and listening. And both, he basically said, drive Leviathan around and have him go get a bunch of jobs and just have him talk to a bunch of realtors and try to get hired out here. And I was like, dude, like what is going on? He wouldn't listen to me when I wanted to do a lot more abstract open thinking. I wanted to just kind of spend night. I just wanted to like chop wood and sit on the mountains and take pictures. And that was good. I was good. That was all I needed. But he was putting me through a much different ringer. And he had said something Wednesday night, too, that was interesting. He said, "If you aren't screaming at me by the time we're done with this trip, then you don't respect me and you don't respect yourself." And I was like, what is he talking about? Like, I don't understand what he means. Well, my buddy's buddy, who's driving me around in the snow in Colorado, is like, "I don't know what's going on with him. I don't know why he's just being like this with you. And we didn't really know what was going on. And it was just really strange." And we go through all of Thursday and I spend the day trying to, I network. I start going into realtors' offices for the first time in my life. I absolutely loved it. I went out and I did some networking. That's its own thing for another day, but I did some networking in Colorado and I loved it. We ended up getting to the house. I don't remember how it was unlocked, but somehow we were able to get home before my buddy got out of work. He came home and said, "We're chopping firewood." And I wanted to chop firewood since I had gotten there. And so I was like, okay, let's go chop some firewood. It's getting really dark. And we're at 12,500 feet, which I've never been at before. And we're going out to, in pitch black, in 4 feet of snow, we're going out to the state park to go grab firewood. When we get out to the state park, there's a like little sled trail in the snow that's maybe 2 feet deep. That's like a trough where people had just drugged their sleds, I guess. And my buddy takes this sled that's like a thin, small little sled. And what he does is he says, "You know, we're taking this sled and we're going to dump a bunch of wood on it. We're going to chop the wood down. We're going to put it on here." And I'm talking, this is the tiniest sled I've ever seen. This is like stupidly tiny. And we're out there and we spend probably like we walk probably a quarter mile before we find something good. And, you know, we chop it down and I notice that none of the wood is staying on the sled. None of it's staying on the sled. And I'm starting to get mad because I'm realizing how stupid this is, that I have to, that somebody's going to have to take all the wood back. And I realize that this is what's going on. Someone's going to have to walk all the way back to the car, like a quarter mile in 4 feet of snow in the bitter cold, in the dark of night where there's bears and wolves. And I see this and I'm starting to realize like someone's going to have to do this. And I had wanted to get away since I got there because I just wanted to get into my own head and stuff, because we didn't bring anything like twine or whatever to make it so that the wood would stay. And so I look at my friend and I'm like, "You know what? Screw this. I'm taking the sled. I'll see you guys." So I take the sled and I start pulling the sled like it's Rocky, I think one, I don't know which, Rocky Balboa in the woods. I'm hauling the sled with 200 probably pounds of wood after I had maxed the day before, after not going to the gym for basically months. And I'm hauling this and I cannot breathe because I'm at 12,000 feet. I cannot breathe. And as I'm walking, I'm listening to music because I had my AirPods in, and it all just kind of came to a head because I just realized that this is what I needed to do. I needed to pull this wood And something just clicked. I can't tell you what it was. The view, it may have been the view, because there was this incredibly scenic view of the city from where we were pulling the wood. I can't tell you where exactly it was, but it was the most beautiful and frustrating. It was like I was so angry that we didn't have twine, that my friend didn't use his brain to bring something to, you know, after telling me what to do for days and days and days and days, this dude would not just do something using his brain. And it was like, I just lost it. I didn't say anything outright, but I just started getting really mad. But it was the kind of mad where I was like, no, this is okay to get really mad about. This is really okay to get mad about. And so I got really mad and I'm pulling this wood all the way to the car. And it takes me like 20 minutes, not even, about 15, 20 minutes of like, because I keep having to catch my breath because I am not acclimated very well to the height. And I finally get this wood all the way to the car and I'm sitting there and I just like, everything clicked. I just realized that I do not have to be pushed over. He's my brother, really. And so I was like, I don't have to let him push me around anymore. I don't. I really don't. And it's gonna be okay if I stand up for myself. So I take the sled, which is tiny, and the 5 tiny pieces of wood and drop them at the car and start walking back. And I walk and I walk and I walk. And they had gone in another quarter mile. So I had to walk half a mile into the woods to find them. And it turns out my buddy found a full tree and he cuts this tree. It was dead. And it was like falling over or whatever. He takes this full tree and he cuts it and it falls. And then he'd been chopping it up for like 30 minutes while I was walking or something. They were like, hey, we thought you got eaten or something. And everything had changed, man. My demeanor had changed completely. I finally was like, no, like we're not. I just started saying things like my buddy makes a lot of money out there because of what the career path he made. He has this sled that's really tiny. And I said, you are so dumb and stupid that you would not just get twine or something or a bigger sled, bro, over here making thousands of dollars a month and you can't like buy a nice sled or something like that. And he looks at me and goes, it was free. And I look at him and I go, yeah, it was free. And I literally yoink a piece of wood out of his hands and throw it in the sled. And I'm like, I'm taking the sled. I don't even know what it was, but it was this adoption of responsibility that felt so good. And it was like I had earned respect from them for pulling the sled. And I was like, I'm going to hold on to this respect, which I sort of fought for. I mean, I picked it up, but I was like, no one's taking this from me. I'm going to be pulling this wood. So I fill up the sled and I start pulling and my buddies are behind me and they notice my demeanor's change. Everything's changed. And I start pulling the sled and I'm hauling this thing all the way back to the car. And you know, the wood's kind of coming out, the snow is falling into the sled. And so it's getting heavy. It was a mess. And whenever they tried to help me, I would be like, don't you touch that wood. And I would do it. Right. We get to the car. I can taste the blood from the breathing, because that's what happens when you do anaerobic exercise. I'm tasting the iron in my lungs and I drop the wood and I get in the Subaru and sit in the back and I say something along the lines of like, so is hot chocolate on the table, gentlemen, or something like that, because they said they wanted some. And my buddy was like, yeah. And their whole demeanor changed, like I said. And my buddy started talking to me and he said he didn't bring twine on purpose. And there were a couple of reasons for this, but long story short, he was trying to set me off. He was trying to get me to a point where I would stand up in my own life. And this is the really dark thematic point. There's an exchange that happens in the car as we're driving to the store to get the hot chocolate. My buddy starts saying things to me, what would normally be considered really rude stuff that he was saying. But like I said, I just learned that it was stuff that was true about me, saying like, you know, you're no good, that you're, you know, sitting around and you're not doing anything in your life, you know. And I just was like, something clicked and I like realized, no, like I'm gonna stand up for myself. And I start screaming at him and I start telling him what I want. I start telling him, you know, you're not listening and all this different stuff. And he finally stops and breaks. And he tells me, and he says, here's the deal, dude. He said he lost 5 friends in the last 3 years or so to self-termination. 5 friends. And in the field he's been in, he's seen crap. And he said, I can't have you be doing that to yourself. I can't lose you like that. That's not an option for me. And that's not an option for you. You cannot be saying the things about the world and about life and reality and how bad things are. I cannot have you continue to be that person. And I said the same thing about myself. I was like, I can't either. And in that car, in that moment, I broke. And I finally said, no, like, I'm going to become the kind of person where being alive is worth it. Like, that's what I said about myself. In that car, in that moment, that experience in Colorado, I said, I'm going to try to become the kind of person where being alive is worth it. And I don't really know how to do that, you know? Like, I don't know. I don't know. I don't have a lot of good role models for that. I have loving relationships with a lot of people, but what that looks like for me, I have to find that out. And that requires risk taking. But I want to become the kind of person where being alive is worth it. Despite all of the crap, despite the stupid economy and the government and politics and some religions and the cults that I don't even want to get started on that I've partaken in, everything, like, despite that, I want to be the kind of person where I still want to get up in the morning because I proved something to myself. Like, the relationship I have with myself is good enough that I want to get out of bed and do something. And I don't think that's a bad thing. And I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to want that. And that was the first time in my entire life that ever happened. And I realized that it was going to be a journey because you don't just, when you become a different person, you don't magically, you know, if you change and become somebody else, you don't magically keep the same friends because they're friends with you because of the way you are with them. And if you change, then you risk losing friends, you risk losing relationships, you risk losing serious commitments to people and to organizations. But is life worth living? Well, I want it to be. And I learned that, or I decided that for myself, that I was going to make a life worth living instead of a life worth just surviving barely and praying to God that I have enough money to make it till the next paycheck and going and digging through quarters for McChicken because I don't have any money in my bank account. Like, I decided, no, like, I'm going to go be the person where I believe that I can do better than that. And I have no framework on, I don't know what I'm doing, but that's what I want. And that's what I wanted in that moment in that car. And I don't ever want to let this go. So now, having had gone on this trip and experienced this, I'm going to the gym every single day because I don't care what people think about me in the gym anymore. If someone was really silly enough and just crass and rude enough to make fun of me for lifting like 15-pound dumbbells or something, I'd look them dead square in the eyes and say, at least I showed up, you know? And that feels good to be able to say that I could finally stand up for myself, you know? Like, as opposed to being like, well, yeah, I kind of suck because I can only do the 15-pound dumbbell. Oh, well, everybody can only do the 15-pound dumbbells until they do something, right? I'm choosing to learn how to become a competent person. But I'm not doing it in some stupid self-help guru crap way. It's like I'm actually, every day I'm getting up and trying something and seeing if it works. And if it doesn't work, I throw it out. And if it does work, I do it again, even if I don't want to. It's through doing it when I don't want to that I respect myself. It's a whole framework shift that I never saw coming so violently for me, you know? And this is why I don't regret the decisions I've made and this trip to go see the mountains and get out of my head so that I can live and experience life. This has been a pretty long episode. It's pretty much over. That's all I've wanted to say. I know there's a lot of people out there. There are a lot of people out there that are going to resonate with a lot of things I said. And do something extreme, man. I mean, I really mean it. Like, don't, like, be careful. Be careful. But I don't think life is, whatever reason you want to have about why we're here, whatever philosophical, religious, whatever reason, they've said that there's a saying, and I'll finish with this. There's a saying that life is 90%, 10% what happens to you, 90% how you react to it. I don't know how much I agree with that, but I do agree that there are a lot of things in life where situations can happen to us. You know, a coworker says something to us that we don't really understand, or, you know, our brain interprets stimuli, and it's up to us to choose whether it's a good thing, a bad thing, or a neutral thing. And I don't think life is something where we have to just be miserable. If there is a grand purpose for us, I believe there is, but if there is a grand purpose for us, I don't think it was one in which we were supposed to just be sad all of the time. I don't, for what? I would rather go on an adventure than sit in my room and be miserable. I'll see you guys on the other side.